This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 68. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week up in beautiful Victoria, Canada?
Just enjoying the weather. It's actually nicer here than it is in Boston, and it's farther north here than it is in Boston.
Right. They get different weather patterns, right? A lot less snow and stuff?
Yeah, there's no snow at all. They said that it snowed once or twice earlier in January, and haven't seen any since. So they're hoping for the best.
For those who haven't been there, it's the Vancouver, Victoria area, and it's just beautiful. If there's any place in Canada I would like to live, it would definitely be up there. It's an awesome city. We were there for 5 nights, my wife and kids and I, last spring, and we had sushi at like 5 different places over the course of that, and it was all really good. So it's a really nice city.
Yeah, it's a great walking city too, which I find nice, because usually the places I'll go, I have to drive around quite a bit, but this place is gorgeous, and it's just fun to walk around and, see all the different things, and, it's a nice city to walk around in.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked it too. It reminded me of Boston because there's the harbor area, there's, some beaches fairly close, it's a walking city, there's good food. Like, it just had a lot of elements that I don't find in a lot of cities. And that's right. Actually, real estate to buy is very expensive, but the other elements are good.
There's been a bunch of foreign
investment. Yeah, yeah. There's been foreign investment that have artificially driven up real estate prices over the past few years. Trust me, I've looked. But anyways, that's why Mike sounds a little funky. The Wi-Fi is just not working for him, and so I'm calling him on. I'm on Skype, but he's on a landline all the way up to Canada. So I'll probably have a short episode here. But I have one thing that we have a little friendly competition going on, it sounds like, with texting. And, we talk a lot about getting reviews and even just getting comments or just getting like 5-star reviews in iTunes. And on the last episode, the texting guys were talking about how they have, I think they have around 50 something, whereas you and I have 75. And so they're trying to go to 100 to beat us. So what I'm saying, people, Startups for the Rest of Us, let's do 125.
Just the friendly competition, right? And they owe us beer if they lose. Is that
friendly,
what this is?
In quotes, indeed. Yeah. Loser buys a round of drinks at MicroConf because they're going to be there, Justin and Jason. So that's our deal. We have between now and April 30th to see who's ahead at MicroConf. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, have a little bit of an advantage because we're already ahead by 25. So anyways, let's get into iTunes, folks, and show texting who's boss.
Cool. I was going to say, speaking of MicroConf, I've been looking for sponsors for MicroConf and talking to a bunch of different people and, trying to kind of lay out what MicroConf is going to look like in terms of the sponsorships. I mean, last year we had Microsoft, we had Redgate, we had BV Software, Ruben sponsored with BitSketch, and all these different companies, including UserVoice and Pluralsight and Balsamic, which Paldi is going to be there from Balsamic this year, and they're a sponsor again this year. So is Ruben over at BitSketch. And, we're just trying to look for other sponsors. So if you know of any sponsors or anyone who might be interested in sponsoring MicroConf, make sure to have them get in touch with me. You can reach me at support@micropreneur.com or...
Yeah, this beer has been awesome. We were almost sold out of tickets already, which never happened last year. And so I think we'll be sold out in the next week or two. We just put them on up for sale last week, and we sold 125 basically in a little less than 2 weeks, I guess. We sold 125 out of 128. So I'm excited because it's going to give you and I time and energy to focus on making the conference really kick ass this year. Not that it didn't last year, but it just to kind of take it to the next level, And so I'm stoked. We have eight of the speakers are nailed down. That includes Peldy and Heaton Shaw and you and myself, Patrick McKenzie, Amy Hoy, if you follow her, Jason Cohen, and Dave Collins from Software Promotions. And then there's 4 spots to be filled, and there's a huge list. For a while, I was getting an email every day at least one or two emails a day with people wanting to talk at MicroConf. So I'm actually glad that the promotion has died down, because it's like, I want to be nice to everyone and I do really want to add them to a list to consider, but it was just becoming too much to manage. It was a bunch of people who, you know, I'd never heard of, and
I have a couple to add to the list as well.
Oh, nice. How about you just go into the Google Doc and do it instead of
sending it? Oh, come on.
So anyways, yeah, there are a few tickets left. You know, obviously you can go to microconf.com, and if you're interested in coming to Vegas in April, it's going to be a blast. We're all going to be there. So my last update is I have 3 days until my new billing code has to execute, and I still haven't finished it, man. I haven't tested it. It was written by a contractor, and he says it works. and
we all know how that goes. It's perfect every time, right?
No, luckily he is a reliable guy. I've used him in the past, so I'm not too concerned about it. But you know, worst case, 4 to 8 hours to get working. But my guess is it'll be less than an hour, and I'll have it up and running. So I just have 3 days to get that done, and I keep putting it off because there's no hard deadline. You know, it'll be the night before, and I'll stay up till 2 a.m. doing it. And I guess that's the plight of an entrepreneur. So we have a cool episode this week. It was from basically a request in the comments of one of our episodes, which is unusual. Typically we get stuff, you know, via Twitter and email and such and voicemails. But this one is good as someone named Tim High, and he had asked about virtual assistants, because you and I have talked about them a lot. And I've recently, you know, hired a couple new virtual assistants, because one of our VAs, she had her master's degree and she wound up getting a good job and getting another gig and just kind of moved on. And so we wished her the best, of course, but she was obviously overqualified for the job, for, you know, what she was handling, email support and stuff for us. But once she moved on, then I went out. And so we've been talking a little bit about recent hires. And so Tim had asked about it, and I had addressed it and just been like, what do you want to know? You know, so he listed, basically outlined the episode for us. Frankly, I think we have 7 or 8 bullet points, and we're just going to kind of throw each one out and then talk about, you know, our best recommendations for doing it. Now, I know, Mike, I know you work with a couple of VAs. I think I may have done it more than you. I think I've been doing it a little longer and I've probably worked with more, but I know that we, you know, kind of, we'll probably both have stuff to add and experience and stuff, but I think I'll kind of lead the episode off just because I feel like I have a lot to say about it, and I answer this question a lot when I speak, so I may be doing more of the talking today.
Probably. I've done it some, but yeah, I think that you've probably done it quite a bit more than I have.
Well, cool. So let's kick this off. The first question is where to find good VAs. And obviously that's a relative question, right? It's like, I'm sure you can find good VAs in a number of places. Over the years, I used to look on Elance, and I don't anymore. I used to look on the like local Craigslist. So I would actually go to the Manila Craigslist, which is obviously in the Philippines. I used to go to a couple of Craigslists in India and look there. I don't do that anymore. I started getting scammed by a few people, and that was pretty irritating. I used to use bestjobs.ph. That they shut that down to foreigners. Then there was another one that I don't even remember what it was, but it was another .ph site that sprang up to serve the people who, you know, weren't able to use Best Jobs. And I found that wasn't very good. It was just very time consuming to sift through everything. What I've finally settled on after all these years, and this is something, who knows if it'll last, but for about the past maybe 18 months, this is what I've been using and this is what I've been recommending to people. And we've mentioned it on the show before, but it's Odesk. There's a solid group of VAs there. There's a lot of virtual assistants, and it's easy and seamless to hire. It's easy to pay them, and it Odesk allows you to track what they do, which I think is perhaps the biggest benefit.
I love that feature in Odesk that you can actually see screenshots and stuff
as
well.
Right, and we've talked about it before. It's like once you trust a VA, like I stop looking through their stuff, but it's like the first month, maybe the first 2 months, I do want to see what they're doing. It takes a screenshot at random times, right? It's like every, I don't know, 4 to 7 minutes it snaps their screen. And so if someone's screwing around, then you know, they're playing solitaire or whatever, then you can ask them about it. You can do whatever. Let them go if you wanted to. I probably wouldn't jump to that conclusion too fast. But it at least allows you to address it. And it means their time is pretty well accounted for. Because when they're billing, you can see their screen. And when they're not, you know, they're not billing. I've had a number of issues hiring independent VAs where I'm pretty sure I got overbilled, you know, pretty sure they were just billing me when they weren't working. So that might be the killer feature that I like most about Odesk. And again, I don't, you know, once I become familiar with someone, I tend to not look at their work diary, but especially starting off, it's invaluable.
Yeah, and you can see the nice part about the screenshots isn't just that you can see when they're, you know, doing things that they shouldn't be billing you for, but it's also it gives you an idea of how they're doing their work and where you can offer suggestions for improvements. So like if they're doing something, if you ask somebody to get you a bunch of data and they're pasting it into Notepad or Word or something like that, and it really needs to be in Excel or something like that, you can point that out to them. Or if, you know, and if they come back and say, well, I don't own Excel, it's too expensive, you can offer up, you know, Open Office or something along those lines, you know, some other tool, or even, you know, Google Docs, where you can get into this, create a spreadsheet in there. Pretty much anything that will actually do the job versus if they're trying to give you something or they're intended to give you something which isn't quite what you were looking for, if you maybe you were a little bit too vague in the description of what the final output was that you were looking for.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. I just caught something this evening. In preparation for this episode, I was looking through a time diary and I was like, oh, wait, why was he doing that? That's the wrong snippet. So I totally emailed my VA and let him know. So I hadn't even thought about that, but that is a cool cool side effect of kind of being able to observe what they're doing.
One of the other things that I really like about Odesk is that when you're posting a job, you actually get a lot of responses. And when I first went to Odesk, one of the things that I was a little concerned about was, oh, I'm posting this job. I'm only willing to pay up to $5 an hour, $1 to $5. And, you know, how many people am I really going to get to apply for this job, which, you know, is probably only a couple of days worth of work, but it's something that I need done. I just don't want to spend the time to actually do it. And I got loads of responses. I think that overnight I got 75 applicants or something like that. It was crazy. And most of these people were only asking, I think the least expensive one was $1.18 or $1.33 per hour. And, you know, obviously it went up from there. And even though when you set a budget or a range, that is more of a guideline for people to follow. They don't necessarily have to provide a rate that is within that range. So I said $1 to $5. Somebody could have said, you know, I'm charging $8 or $9 and still applied for it. It's just they're going to be probably a bit of a disadvantage because I have already said that my rate is 1 to 5. But if you come in a little bit higher and I think that you are much more qualified for the job than anyone else, then I can still go with you. And there's no restriction from that. But and the opposite is true as well. If somebody came in below $1, and I think there was one person who came in, now that I think about it, I think somebody came in at like 67 cents an hour and wasn't really well qualified for what I was looking for.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything that cheap. Wow.
It was ridiculous. I mean, but it was just, you know, tabulating some data that I needed done. I think it cost me a grand total of $18 or something like that.
Got it. Yeah, I see. That makes sense. So maybe they thought they could just do it fast or something. Yeah, that's kind of weird. I've never hired anyone less than, I think, $3 an hour is kind of the lowest I've ever actually hired.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you did a project-based, maybe someone could bid less than that, but I don't know. That sounds crazy. Even in other parts of the world, that's not a lot of money, you know?
No, it wasn't. But, you know, it got the job done. It did what I needed to do, and it was well worth the $18.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. The way I've started doing it with Odesk is if... You know, I used to just sift through the candidates and not post projects and try to just pick people out. Eventually, you have to post a project in order to hire someone, which is fine because it gets you more candidates. But now, if it's a project that I really want, you know, an experienced person on, I definitely go through, I search for them, and then I'll post the project, and then I'll go out and invite a handful of people that I think are especially well qualified for it. And typically, like half of them just won't apply. They're either busy, or I imagine they just aren't interested, or they don't get the email, or whatever. And then the other half do wind up applying, and they tend to be kind of my top tier candidates right off the bat. But what I've been surprised about is, like you said, in addition to that, there are always a bunch of other candidates that have kind of meet the criteria that I didn't find just by searching for them. And that's been the part I've liked. So if you do post a project, I would recommend not leaving it private because you want to post it publicly because I really do think, you know, you're going to get people coming out of the woodwork that fit your needs for the job.
the other thing that I would probably recommend is that if it's something that you don't necessarily want to describe in exquisite detail in the job posting, what you can do is you can simply list kind of generalities around what it is that they're going to be doing. You don't have to say, oh, I want you to do market research for, you know, X. Now, you know, on this particular company, you can say, I want you to do market research on a company in the pharmaceutical industry, and here's the type of information I need you to look up or research or whatever. Those are the sorts of things you can do. If it's a technical posting, and I understand this episode's about virtual assistants, but you could just simply start listing the technologies that you intend to be used on the project, and people with those skills are going to apply, which is fantastic the way that it works. I'm still shocked that sometimes I'll post something out there, and it's just you get people coming out of the woodwork applying for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something I'd make a recommendation for folks posting is to have some personality in your posting. Like, don't seem like some kind of corporate jerk who has all these requirements and you're kind of iron fisting. Like, I've seen some that say, like, do not apply unless you meet all of the following requirements, you know, and it's
yeah.
in cap. And it's like,
I don't like that.
Well, you're a jerk. Yeah. And you're not going to get the best people. There are some really good people on Odesk, and you imagine I wouldn't want to work for that person. So I always say, like, we are a tight team. You know, we hire good people and let them go do it. We don't micromanage, blah, blah, blah. I only use we when it's you and I. Like, I hired a VA recently for the Academy. It was in December. And I totally sold the gig. You know, I wasn't just saying, here's, you know, $8 an hour or $10 an hour. I wasn't just saying, here's a position that's open. I mean, I was really saying, like, here's why it's cool. Like, the people we deal with are really nice. We treat them very well. We offer refunds when they ask. Like, we don't screw our customers. You're going to feel good about working for us. And, you know, told them a little bit about you and I, and just kind of, I talked about why it was a cool gig, and we got really good applicants for it. And we wound up finding someone who's doing a great job. And I think, you know, he's 10 or 11 bucks, and he's in North America. And, you know, for that, I mean, it's just totally worth it for us not to handle that, all the tier one email support. In addition, I have other VAs. I guess I just want to throw it out. Like, I do have a VA that works for me that's about $350 an hour. She populates some job boards and does some tier one email support for some more niche items. And I don't need as high end a support on those products. They just are, you know, different kinds of products. And so that might give you folks out there the range of what they should expect from VAs. I think this also might be a good, and you can certainly go up from there. I mean, if you really do, you know, if you come into the States, if you go to the coasts, you're going to pay 20 to 30 to 40 bucks an hour. You can find fantastic VAs that can really, you know, do all types of stuff, answer phones and make outgoing calls and such. We don't have that need. I think another thing we should talk about briefly is that the term virtual assistant is a very loose term. And I think you and I use it similarly. It really is someone who can help with admin work and emails incoming and outgoing and some email support and that kind of stuff. As soon as I hire someone who's writing code, managing websites, has technical skill, I tend to call them developers or webmasters or graphic designer if they're doing design. You know, I don't mix the term VAs. I know some folks do. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of want to throw that out there as we, and, you know, a marketing guy, actually, I'm in the process of, I just had a Skype call yesterday with a guy who's probably going to help me out with some marketing tasks on Hittail, both giving me feedback and doing just some of the execution. And so I wouldn't consider him a VA at all. And he's much more expensive than a typical VA would be. I mean, he's more of a, you know, a marketing consultant type thing. So I really do see a difference between those, you know, the term VA and those other, kind of those other monikers.
He's a virtual marketing expert.
Yeah, totally. That was actually Tim. Another one of Tim's question was, you know, are there different types of VAs? And so that one's there. Let's see. Tim also asked, are there geographical considerations in terms of hiring VAs? And I imagine in terms of hiring all remote workers, he's asking this. And I'll throw out a few that I've seen. I found that working with people in my time zone does tend to work better, but of course it's harder to find, you know, the pool is smaller, right? Because there is a larger pool of folks if you can go around the world. Western Europe and India and Eastern Europe are obviously on really different time zones than California. So I will tend, if I know that I need to communicate with them often, then I will tend to look in North America or South America. Or Canada, of course, just because the time zone is so close. Because an 8-hour time difference is actually, you know, it's kind of tough.
It's a full day.
Yeah, right. Because like my mornings are hard because I'm trying to get the kids out the door, and so I either have to talk with them really late at night, my time, which where I'm not at my best, or I try to just cram them in the morning. I mean, it really does just throw off our workday. So I think that's one thing to think about. It's not the end of the world. Most, I'd say 75% of my people that work for me, I think I have like 9 or 10 contractors right now doing some form of work for me. And I'd say 75% of them, maybe 80% of them, are 8 hours or more off of my time. So you can totally do it. It just depends on if you really need to collaborate. It can be, you know, it can be a little tricky at times.
Yeah, I think the time zone is the biggest issue for me as well, because, you know, I'm further east than you are. So that's an additional 3 hours for me. And that just means when I first get up in the morning and I check my email, if there are questions, I have to answer them either immediately in order to get any sort of, you know, their working day, you know, to proceed with those new instructions or those updates or whatever. Or if I wait a couple of hours, then by that time they're off doing other things and, you know, going to bed, which, you know, obviously they're entitled to do, but it just makes it hard because you have to allocate that time either first thing in the morning, or you have to understand that if you don't do that, there's still a possibility that they're not going to be working for the rest of the day, because there are people who don't keep track of the same hours that we do. I mean, some people will work a little bit before breakfast, and sometimes, you know, they don't start until after lunch. You're not really in control of their schedule per se. You're really more in control of the work that they do and the output. You're not so much in control of what hours specifically that they keep. And I think that you can, you know, you can talk to people and say, hey, I really need you to keep these hours if it's something very specific and there's a good reason why. But for the most part, that's not really going to apply.
Typically, if I think that at the beginning of a project is typically when you're going to need to do more collaboration, and so I will say that up front, like, you know, we need to at least have 3 hours of overlap with Pacific time, you know, 10 to 4 or whatever hours I'm working that week. And I don't find that being a problem. And then from then on, once someone's, you know, kind of rolling with it and they know what they're doing, you don't tend to need as much overlap. I think the other thing in terms of geography is you need to figure out how big of a deal a language barrier is going to be. And you need to figure out how well someone needs to speak English or your native language in order for things to work. And there's a wide range of this, right? It's like a developer does not have to have perfectly fluent, you know, written or spoken English in order to write really good code. As long as they understand your spec and can, you know, ask questions, they don't need to be as good as someone who's, say, answering your tier one email support of, you know, your prized product, like with the Academy or with Hittail or something. I just want to, you know, it's got to be a native English speaker in that case. And so that's the other kind of geographical or cultural concern, I would say, is realize that there's obviously going to be varying degrees of written English skills and spoken English skills across developers, across virtual assistants handling email support, and across, you know, even designers and all that stuff as to how well they can understand your requirements. So I tend to pay pretty close attention to that early on, ask some questions up front after someone replies to a project. Once I put them on my short list, then I will tend to ask some very specific questions and see what their response is like, and see if they give me a full response, see if they capitalize their letters and put punctuation. I mean, because it's a big deal, right? I don't want all like lowercase replies. It just, to me, it shows a lack of professionalism. And so I think that's, you know, kind of the first couple steps is, in my opinion, on Odesk, is to post a project, get the responses, start weeding people out, and then start sending some poignant questions about someone's work day. Do they work a full-time job? Are they consultant? What hours do they work? Do they work from home or from an office? Do they work with other people? I mean, these are kind of the things that I save and then ask final candidates in order to see what their response is and to see kind of an unedited version. Because their cover letter may be really nice, but it tends to be, you know, edited by someone else. So you get more of a real life response. If you keep some questions, you can ask them later.
Yeah, I do basically the same thing.
So Tim's next question is, how do you evaluate them to see if they're efficient and will do the job right? And this is, let's just stick to VAs here, because I think we could try to cover designers and developers and all these different things, but it's such a big topic. With VAs, I tend to narrow it down really quickly, and then I will either pick a small sample project that I'll give to two or three people, and I'll hire those three people and then give them all the same project. Or if I have a good feeling about someone, I will just pick them and I will get them started right away, and then I will just evaluate them every day and see what they're doing, see how they're doing it, see how they communicate. And then maybe I'll drop to once a week, and then pretty soon, you know, they're off and running. And you can tell within a couple of days if they're going to work out almost every time. And I've been able to either let someone go or, you know, or just keep them on based on that. So I don't know if you have any other secrets, Mike, but that's how it's always been. To me, it's like trying to give them tests up front or anything like that is a waste of time until you see how they actually deal with what they're going to need to do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and I think with VAs especially, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's unskilled labor because you really need them to, you know, be skilled at what they're doing. But it's one of those things where you need to, you know, they need to have certain people skills. They need to have certain email etiquette skills. And, you know, ODesk, for example, actually has it tests for, you know, what their English is like and what their email etiquette. I think there's an email etiquette certificate or something like that. But, you know, you can ask them all the questions in the world, and who knows what those questions are going to say about that. I mean, it's really no different than interviewing somebody in person. I mean, until you're working side by side with somebody, you know, that's just a completely different ballgame. So, you know, I kind of feel the same way you do. You kind of have to just make a decision, hire somebody, and understand that those first 10 hours or 20 hours, you may have to completely write them off. But if you hire somebody and, you know, let's say the rate is, you know, $8 an hour or something like that, and you hire them for 20 hours and it doesn't work out, you're out $160. That's it.
Typically, you're going to know well before 20 hours is up.
Right.
Almost every case. Unless they just flake on you, which I've had happen. Unless that happens, then you're going to know pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about that is that if it's like a one-off job, though, chances are it doesn't really matter. You know, you can hire somebody, and, you know, if they don't work out, you just go on to the next person you hire them. But if you're looking for more of a long-term relationship, then those, you know, first 15 or 20 hours are going to be pretty critical, and they'll help you evaluate whether that person is worth hiring in the future. And I think that's probably the more important piece of it is, you know, do I keep this person around? Are there other things I can send to this person that will, you know, move my task list along?
That is huge. That is the big thing, right? It's not to have to search every time you need a task done, not to have to run a whole job search, because they are time consuming. And the idea of finding good people and keeping them around for years is exactly what I've done. And I totally recommend that to people. Even if they're not doing ongoing tasks for you, just having a kind of a short list of people who can help you out. So in, you know, 2 months, you haven't talked to them for a month or two, and you're just like, hey, do you have any availability this week? 5 hours of work to do some research, or 5 hours of work to sort through these, you know, whatever, these Excel spreadsheets that are a mess. And if you have a short list of folks who can do that stuff for you, it is crazy time you can save by delegating to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think this actually brings up one of Tim's other comments was, what jobs are the right kinds to delegate to VAs? And I think that obviously, the ones that are most obvious and the ones that will save you the most time are things that are recurring, because you can train them once, you create a process, put it in a Google Doc, it's a bulleted list of the items, then you record a screencast of it so they get a single, you know, a visual view of it, but they'll refer back to the bullets in the future. And Tier 1 email support is awesome for that if you've set up a bunch of snippets and you train them on how the app works and then just let them go. And dealing with PayPal crap where you have to log in and refund and request payments and just doing all that, it is super time consuming, but it's not hard work. And so you don't want to be doing that. You know, you don't need to have like an entrepreneur doing that. You can totally have basically an admin assistant doing these things. And once you train them, they can do it for years. And both you and I have had folks doing this. And that, to me, has been, over my career as an entrepreneur, has been the biggest time saver, is that kind of email support and admin work. I think the other thing we noticed pretty quickly is, like, with the Academy, there started being these monthly recurring processes we have to run. So, like, the first day of every month, we have to look at everyone who's been there X month, and we have to do a certain thing. And it's something that's virtually impossible to truly automate with code or anything, because otherwise we would do that. And so you and I were doing it manually for a long time, and suddenly I realized, like, why don't we have a VA do this? Like, we can totally create a process for this. And so those are the other things. And so you and I haven't done that for 18 months. And if you add up the time, you know, it may only take like 2 hours each time, but that's 36 hours over 18 months. It's big, man. It's like 2 hours out of that 1 week means, you know, how many more sales? That's an entire, like, I can write a blog post in 2 hours. So that was another blog post I wrote because I was basically able to delegate this admin task. And then I think the other things are like with MicroConf. I just emailed our Micropreneur Academy VA and I said, how much, you know, time do you have each week? Because I'm going to start needing a bunch of coordination with speakers. And this is kind of a one-time-ish thing, but I'm basically going to have a Excel spreadsheet full of speakers. He needs to get all, email them individually. We don't want to do a big bulk list, and individually try to get all this info from them, book their hotels. Like, there's some very specific things, but they're pretty easy to lay out, right? I can say, you need to do these five things and send him an email that does this. And so that, I think that's another kind of pretty good task. It's not recurring, but over the course of a couple of weeks, it will save me a bunch of logistical headache, and it'll definitely save several hours of work. I would guess somewhere between 5 and 15 hours of work over the course of maybe 4 to 6 weeks is what that single delegation will save me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've toyed with the idea recently of outsourcing somebody to look at my email.
I know. Yeah, we've talked about this. I really do think there's some value in there. It depends on what you get in your email, like what if everything needs a personal response. But I have been going through that exercise of when I look at my inbox, I try to think, could someone else, if they knew me well, you know, because this is not some, it's not a robot. It's someone who actually knows, they need to know your kind of your businesses. They need to know how you would respond, what you would think about it. And the more they learn that, the better they can respond. And I've been trying to think if someone else could do it. And to date, I think it would be a waste of time for my inbox personally, but that right. doesn't say anything about yours. You know, I'm getting a lot of individual business offers. Hey, you know, about the book or about coming to speak or whatever. It's things I need to evaluate individually, that a VA would then assign to me anyway. So I may as well just reply to them up front.
Hmm.
So.
Yeah, I don't want to say it's a glorified spam filter, but there are certain things that could obviously just kind of get dumped, and you know, or somebody could just kind of not necessarily give someone a cold shoulder or just kind of back off and say, look, I really don't have time for this particular business partnership or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, as long as you put specific parameters around, these are the types of things I'm not interested in.
Right. Yeah. You'd have to define that pretty well. I'd be concerned that my guy would actually, you know, accidentally turn someone away that maybe I would have considered. And it's kind of hard to put parameters on that.
Yeah. And that's kind of been my fear as well. It's just really hard to put your own judgment calls in somebody else's head. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, it is. And I think that's what, like, most recently getting my VA in charge of who does Hittail Tier 1 support now. He's basically doing customer service. He's the front-facing person for Hittail. I've worked with him for a little while before I did that, right? Because you could easily screw that up pretty bad if you make bad decisions or obviously if you were rude or something, that would be terrible. I totally knew he wasn't going to do that. But I really have to trust that he's going to handle things well. And I've given him, you know, I won't say carte blanche, but I've given him a lot of leeway and asked him, like, you know, to make judgment calls. Yeah. That, and I say, like, tell me about them later, you know, like, then just let me know what you've done. And then I will say, you know, I would have done it differently, or let's do it differently in the future or something like that. But so far there's been, I think, one out of like 10 pretty challenging judgment calls. There's only been one that I was like, I probably would have done it differently, but it really doesn't matter. You know what I'm
right.
saying? And the amount of time that I didn't have to spend dealing with those, the amount of decision time, and the fact that he now knows that business, he's starting to get to know Hittail really well, get to know the customers individually. That is some invaluable stuff right there. Like, he's working his way in as a pretty valuable part of the business, honestly.
Yeah, and it's funny you put it like that, because I've seen a couple of companies where they basically, when they bring on new employees, they tell them, you know, look, I don't want to be bothered with this stuff. You know, you're part of the company now. You need to make some of these decisions. When something comes up, don't ask me about it. Don't ask these other people. You make a decision, and then we'll deal with the consequences of it later. If it was a bad decision, we'll talk about it, you know, and that way you can learn from then on. But the thinking behind it is, how much money could I possibly lose from a bad decision that might happen, versus giving somebody, you know, as you said, carte blanche to just do whatever they think is the right thing to do, and then evaluate later whether it was or it wasn't.
Right. That'll save you more money in the long run, because they'll make 100 decisions that you don't have to be involved in. And maybe one or four or whatever, a small amount, won't work out. And it's like you said, you'll lose a little bit of money there, but you make it up in not having to deal with all those other ones
mm-hmm.
that go perfectly well. So, Let's see, we got a couple things left. Tim says, do you generally work with the same VA all the time, or is the relationship more anonymous than that? I've done both. I've actually worked with a pretty large kind of VA firm, and I do still use them. These days, I prefer to find a VA on Odesk, build a relationship, and then be able to use them for ongoing tasks. One-off stuff comes up. It's just so much easier because they know me, I treat them well, they treat me well, and I respect them and know that they're gonna be able to come through for me. So I think when you're getting started, if you feel nervous about that, you know, potentially you could go with a larger company. They're going to be a little more expensive, probably in the $6 to $12 an hour range, I would think, for a VA that you might get for half the price, say, on Odesk. But, you know, then you know someone's always there to cover you. I mean, if they get sick, they won't bail on you because it's basically, you know, a larger corporation handling things. So there's some stuff to weigh out. I think once you become more comfortable with it, most people will want to move away from that, my guess is, and kind of build a relationship with someone.
Or multiple people. I mean, if you can build that small pool, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And as I said, I have a lot of folks, you know, doing some kind of work for me. I think in the last 30 days, I've had 9 people bill, you know, at least an hour worth of work doing something. And some of them are developers and some are designers. I mean, geez, I had a CSS guy doing something on Hittail, and then we got an email that, you know, there was like a weird IE9 only CSS bug, you know, in MicroConf, and you emailed it to me in the MicroConf site. And I'm like, there's no way I want to do that. You or I could fix that, right? It would take me like 2 hours to do it. It's such a pain, but we could do it. You know, we know the technology, but instead I just popped it over to this guy who I'm now using for a ton of stuff. I had him reskin a WordPress blog. I had him reskin a form. He just knows CSS really well. So, and he solved that MicroConf stuff in like, I don't know, it was maybe an hour, and he's $22 or $25. Totally worth it for you and I not have to do that, right? And now the site looks great. And he noticed some other things. He's like, yeah, and, you know, in Mac, Chrome, it'll also do this. And so I fixed that while I was in there. And it's just like, now that, I wouldn't have caught that. You know, he's actually better than we are at it. And, you know, it doesn't take our time to do it. So definitely a win-win. And then let's see, the next question. What's the typical rate? Is it always hourly, or are there longer-term agreements?
You can do both, especially with Odesk. It gives you the option to do a per project rate or per hour rate. My preference is to do per hour, because I think if you do a per project rate, you're essentially putting forth the expectation that it will probably take about this amount of time. So let's say you tell people, I estimate this will take about 10 hours worth of work or 8 hours worth of work, whatever. And then they'll put in their bids, and basically their bids are, you know, whatever they are. But the problem that you have with that is that, you know, they're going to try and go through as quickly as they possibly can, because if they're able to do that job in an hour, then it basically just made 10 times what they probably would have if they had, you know, taken up the whole 10 hours to do the job. So they're going to go as quickly as they can. Chances are that they're going to make more mistakes. And, you know, it's your output is not going to be quite as good. The other side of that is that, assuming that they're not trying to hurry, they are putting forth the good effort. The other part of the coin is that after a certain point, it doesn't become cost effective for the person doing the work to continue doing the work. And essentially you've said, I will pay you, you know, X for this particular output, and I expect it to take 10 hours, and their expectation is, oh, it should take 10 hours or less. But let's say that they get to 15 hours or 20 hours, and what your expectations are far beyond the time commitment that they, you know, promised, they're not going to want to continue, and chances are good that the whole thing's just going to fall apart. So my preference is to do hourly stuff. Now, there are certain cases where doing a per project basis will work out for you just great. But essentially you're kind of taking a chance at that point. I do a lot of consulting work, and I never do a per project basis at this point. It's always, you know, on a time and materials basis. And that's kind of a little bit of the difference between them. There's a fixed rate or time and materials, and the time and materials is by far better when you're concerned with what the output is. Because you can just say, this is exactly what I want. Oh, you didn't finish. Okay, well, let's keep going until this thing is finished.
Right. And of course, there's a vetting process up front to make sure the person, you know, isn't going to take forever to do it, right? You give them a small project to make sure they can do it, and then you trust them. You start building a small relationship with them, and then you give them the next thing. So it's not like you're going to give them this tiny task and let them spend 20 or 30 hours on it, right? I mean, you can limit how much in Odesk, you can limit how many hours they can bill in any given week. And so you can email them and say, I expect this to take 2 hours, and give them 2 hours for that week to do it. Especially early on, I totally do that. I keep it very clamped down. Mm-hmm. And then as things get on, I'll give them more and more leeway with it. In addition, you know that someone can't just not work and bill you, you know, overbill you, because like we talked about, it tracks their hours. So I agree. I have done hourly with everyone with two exceptions. One, I needed an ebook design, and I just put how much I was willing to pay for it. I had a number in my head that was worth it to me. And, you know, I think it was $150 or something. And I threw it out there, and everyone who applied, you know, I evaluated their portfolio, picked the best one. And then I worked with the person and did a few revisions, and they nailed it. The other thing is I had an infographic designed, and I did the same thing. I just had a certain budget amount in my head that I wanted to pay. And I didn't feel super comfortable paying someone by the hour for those two projects. And they were pretty well defined, right? I mean, even with the infographic, I had the entire list of stuff like, you're going to build an infographic with this data. I already had the thing, you know, basically typed up. So limited exceptions. Even designing a website, I probably would not do that. I would probably go hourly, you know, because I would want someone to have the flexibility to really go the extra mile and not feel like they're pulling money out of their pocket to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think designing specific graphics or icons or something like that is a little different, because that's kind of a creative process, and it's really hard to put, you know, if somebody's really good at what they do, it's almost like golf. The better you are, the less you do it. You know, I mean, if you're Tiger Woods, you're swinging the club a lot less than you would, you know, if you're somebody like me. And, you know, he obviously gets paid a lot more for that. But I think when you're getting logos or designs and stuff like that, sometimes it's just worth it to pay on a per project basis, because there's a certain amount of creativity that comes when people are not sitting at their computer. You know, you're doing other things, and, you know, maybe you're making dinner or something like that, and you see something and say, hey, that'd be a great, you know, a little tweak here or there on this particular object, and this would make a great icon. I mean, some things just come to you, and you're not sitting there in front of a computer. It's not like Odesk can really track that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, I think the other part of his question is, what's the typical rate? And I mentioned it a little bit before, but for VAs, for true admin help, I typically see between, you know, maybe $3 an hour up to $15 an hour for international. And then, I don't know, if you're looking more in the U.S., you're probably going to look between $8 and about $30 an hour, depending on the qualifications you want. And for other things, I mean, like I said earlier, CSS guy I have is $25 an hour. He's not in the U.S., but he's very good. And so he can charge me what he needs very fast. So he can charge me what he wants. I think the highest I've paid is in the 50s for some very specialized work I had done. But tends to be, you know, most of my stuff is between, I'd say, about $5 and maybe $20-$25 an hour, depending on the task. And the more technical and the more skilled, obviously, the higher up it goes. So, and I guess the third part of his question is, are there any long-term agreements? And I haven't done any long-term agreements with anyone. But that's not to say, if you could provide someone, you know, more full-time contracts, I'm sure you could just say, hey, it's, you know, X $100 a month or X thousand or whatever. And bring them on more as almost a full-time contractor type thing. But I haven't had the need to do that. So,
yeah, I have a guy who I hired, and I kind of capped him at 20 hours just to kind of see what his work was going to be like. And then after I took a look at what he was doing, and he's like, oh, I did this over here and did this over there, and I think it'd be best if I did it this way. And I didn't get an email from you, so I just went ahead and did this because it looked like the right thing to do. And I just, you know, was looking at his work, and I said, all right, you know, basically I just kind of on the spot increased it from a cap of 20 hours for the week up to 40. And,
right.
You know, I sent him a quick short email and just saying, hey, you know, what are your thoughts on this? I'd like to bring you on for a little bit longer, you know, a little bit more work and more long-term stuff. And right now I've got him, you know, working up to 40 hours a week at this point.
Nice. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I think that's a good point with what you just said too, is I'm always very I never send people stuff and say, oh, hey, do this for me. I always say, here's a task. Are you interested? Do you have availability? Please let me know. Even mm-hmm. with people who I've worked with for years, it's like, it's just a matter of respect. It's like, they are really contractors. They're not your employee. You don't have them full time. And so you really should like ask. I feel like that. And I always ask and I always get a good response from that. People say they appreciate the fact that I'm genuinely asking, I'm not just, kind of demanding that they do it.
Yeah, this one, I even asked him before I sent it, before I even switched things over to 40 hours a week. I just said, hey, what are your thoughts on this? This is what I'd like to do. Do you have availability? Are there other things you're working on? And he came back and said, yeah, I'd love to. I've got a couple of other projects I got to finish up first. But after those are all set, I'd love to.
Right. That's cool. So Tim's last kind of question is tips on organizing and communicating the work so you get a positive net savings on your time. And I think that the biggest piece of advice I'd say is to start with things that are recurring. Start with things that come up more than once, because those are by far going to give you the most savings over the long term. You can definitely do one-off tasks. I tend to not, unless I have someone who just knows the deal and I can send them like a 5-minute email, which I do have now, I can send a 5-minute email and I can delegate tasks that are like 30 minutes now and actually make up, 5-6x on that, because it really does take me 5 minutes to explain in an email or a screencast. If you don't have that, then obviously if you really need to go out and do a search and find someone to do something, then it does tend to need to be 2 to 4 hours, I would say, of work in order to even begin to be worthwhile. And obviously the more the better. I think in terms of communicating it, I've found screencasts to be super, super valuable, because you can just talk to something, show them what to do, and it really is helpful. I've also found backing it up with a kind of a bulleted list in a Google Doc that they can not only read, but then they can update as the process changes. I found it's very, very valuable.
Yeah, and in terms of hosting those screencasts, I've used, I think you use this as well, screencast.com.
I do.
And, I think that it's free up to 2 gigabytes. And then beyond that, in terms of space for the videos, I think you get up to 25 gigs for $10 a month or something like that. It's not very expensive. It's pretty darn cheap for what it is, especially considering the value that you get out of it.
Right.
And you can also set up privacy and sharing between the different URLs and things like that. You can organize things into folders. So like I have a developer folder where I put stuff in there for development and, for mostly the different tools that I use. So, I use Mercurial and ThoughtBugs and basically just have walkthroughs of this is how you use this. This is, how and why you label your bugs this way so that they show up here and et cetera, because not everybody uses the same tools that you do.
Yeah, and that's a big deal, right, is to have repeatable screencasts. Because
mm-hmm.
if anytime you can record a screencast that you're going to use multiple times in the future, it's like you're like minting time. You're like creating time for yourself. Because what I've seen a lot of people do, and I hear them, they're like, yeah, I'm going to jump on Skype with someone and show them how to use this. And I'm thinking to myself, that is a terrible idea. Like, record a 7-minute screencast of that, because you absolutely know you're either going to bring another person on later, this guy's going to flake, you're going to need another person. I mean, something's going to happen. You should reuse that multiple times. And I have screencasts that I've used with 5 different people, and instead of having 5 different Skype calls, I mean, it's just, that is really, this is where you start getting that flywheel effect, where the more assets you get, you have instructions on how to use all of your stuff. Like you said, your source control and your bug tracking and your, whatever other email stuff that you've set up. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and it saves you a lot of time in the long run.
Yeah, I think that's probably the one other comment I would have about, Tim's question about tips on organizing and communicating, because, what you're really looking for is putting documentation or screencasts or whatever is out there so that you don't have to do it again. It's not just, you're hiring one person to kind of replace yourself. It's really you're putting together this repeatable process that is, I don't want to say it's self-documenting, but it is a documented process that somebody else could follow without any additional input from you. I mean, you should be able to just point them to this stuff and say, this is what you need to do, or this is what you need to know in order to be able to do this job effectively. And you put that stuff together once, and you don't have to do it again.
I think the last thing I'd say is every day when I look at my task list and look at what I'm going to do today, I try to look at it and say, what can I delegate? what can I get rid of on this list that anyone who's currently working for me, anyone in, you know, whether they're on Odesk or elsewhere, could possibly do for me so that I don't have to spend the time to do it. And I have decent luck. You know, I tend to have to refresh myself every 30 days. I'll find myself doing crappy tasks that I don't want to do. The things I procrastinate on, I try to figure out how can I get these off my plate. And I think that's a big deal. I think especially the more customers you get, kind of the more your startup or your product evolves, when you first start, it may be harder to find tasks, but pretty quickly you're going to come across a lot of things that really are ripe for outsourcing to folks. I think that probably wraps us up for today. You want to take us out?
Absolutely. If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please, please, please write a review in iTunes so that we can beat the texting guys, and all you have to do is search for startups, or you can subscribe to us in the podcast via RSS. Or iTunes. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsforrestofus.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.